Thank you. Yeah, it's great to be speaking here today. I guess my presentation is very much a scene setter for what is to follow. I've been asked to speak about the evolving story of food allergy over the last few decades. I suppose you could, in fact, if you wanted to look at the history of food allergy, you could go back maybe even hundreds or thousands of years where there have been recorded instances of things happening that were probably allergy. But it would probably take all day to cover that span of time. So what I'm going to be covering is very much a personal story, but I hope my personal story will bring perspective to the bigger picture, and some of these events that I'm about to tell you about, I'm sure you'll know about already. With some apologies, very much a UK story, not entirely, but I mean, that is where my experience has been mainly with working with allergy in this country. But I think it still will resonate with anybody, I guess anybody around the world. Right, so it's the right click? No, it's not. Oh, yeah, okay, got it. Okay, well, this is more than two decades ago, but this was a book by Richard McInnes. And the reason I put that one up back in 1976 is because it was he was one of the guys who brought food allergy, which I put in quotes there, brought food allergy to the public domain with this very popular book called Not All in the Mind, where he talked about food allergy. In fact, really, if you look at it now, you'll realise that there is a great muddling of food allergy and food intolerance. But as far as the public are concerned, Richard McInnes, who lived in Basingstoke, Hampshire, worked from there, was quite a figure in the early story of food allergy. But just to kind of get the definition right early on, although there was this muddling in the public mind around that time, and still is to some extent, what I will be talking about mainly today, and I guess many of the other speakers will be mainly focusing on allergy with a strict definition of occurring when the immune system reacts adversely to a food or substance that's harmless for most people. And as we all know, anaphylaxis is at the extreme end. Whereas food intolerance doesn't generally involve the immune system. It's a different thing altogether, really. It requires larger amounts of food. Symptoms take longer to occur, and one example would be lactose intolerance. But my talk this morning will mainly focus on allergy because that's where my expertise has been, working first of all, as many of you will know, with the anaphylaxis campaign. This is what I'm talking about with the muddling of allergy, where it becomes very, very fashionable, I think, in some circles to say, I've got an allergy. And I'm sure that in many cases, we're not talking about allergy at all. But, of course, allergy is a very real subject that we're all passionate about. And these are some of the early milestones in real allergy, where people, for example, Hugh Sampson and many others, Hugh Sampson in America, Wesley Burks, John Warner, and the list can go on, and indeed Steve here. The work of these people really began to put allergy in its rightful place. So we had, for example, Hugh Sampson's work on food challenges and predictive values for skin and IgE antibody assays, and his work on the identification of asthma as a major risk factor for fatal allergy. And indeed, we had the Isle of Wight research, which I think has been a milestone, certainly in this country, showing the rapid and steep rise in peanut allergy. Now, this is the story of why I got involved back in 1993. That's my daughter, Sarah, pictured with me. Sarah was a very atopic little girl who had asthma and eczema as a child. And she had this kind of vague story that she was allergic to peanuts, but it was never taken very seriously either by her doctor or by me. And one day, quite out of the blue and quite suddenly, she She was on her own. She was in a restaurant, and she ate a dessert, and it killed her. And being a journalist at the time, I worked very hard on trying to find out exactly what had happened, because the paramedic had simply listed asthma as the cause, but I knew it wasn't, and my wife knew it wasn't. So to cut a long story short, we got involved in finding out what the problem was. And as it emerged at the inquest with evidence from the pathologist, she died of peanut-induced anaphylaxis, peanut being in the dessert which she ate in a restaurant in Guildford. So that was my beginnings in food allergy. And around that time, I've headed this tragedy, A Catalyst for Change. We had a number of other deaths of young people which were very high profile in the UK media. Josephine Turner ate a pretzel containing peanut butter and died. Michaela Mortimer died in 1993 after eating a peanut wafer at her school. Both of those happened down in the West Country. And Rachel O'Neill died also in 1993 after eating peanuts in a Thai meal. And all of these cases became very heavily covered in the UK media. For me, this was quite a milestone paper, simply because it was the first time I'd really looked at anaphylaxis and started to realize that there was a mystery there to be solved. This was David Hyde writing in 1993, talking about there being a paucity of data on the prevalence or frequency of deaths, stating that deaths may be wrongly recorded, saying quite clearly that it's all very well saying avoid the allergen, but that's easier said than done. And he said, even before the formation of help groups, he said that a self-help group would put pressure on manufacturers in order to raise the profile of food allergy. And indeed, that's what happened. And sadly, David died in 1996, I think it was, the day of a conference in Leatherhead, where he just given a very, very good presentation. But that for me was one of the milestones. And I mean, going back years and years, we've got self-help groups and support organizations springing up, Asthma UK, Celiac UK, Food Allergy and Anaphylaxis Network in the USA, Allergy UK in 1991, the Anaphylaxis Campaign, and many other groups around the world. The Anaphylaxis Campaign is the organization that I helped to found in 1994 as a result of what happened to Sarah. Very quickly, this was drawing a huge amount of interest, particularly amongst families where there had been severe and sudden reactions. But the people concerned had thought that this was something rather freakish, that perhaps their family was the only family affected. But as we soon found, there were hundreds and hundreds of people coming to us, literally hundreds of people coming to us within the first year. And it was clear that this was a bigger problem than we had all thought. So there's the Anaphylaxis Campaign. That's the organization that I helped to set up. It helps individuals with severe allergies, seeks to ensure high-quality allergen labeling, promotes awareness in the catering sector, runs online training for schools, various information tools, and many other things. That's just one or two of the objectives the campaign has, but there are many, many more, and I'm sure some of you are familiar with the organization. So in the 1990s, it was very much a media scare story, and those are some of the headlines I cut out and used as a collage. If you have food allergy in the family, it can be very scary to see that kind of thing. It's serious, but as we all know, the media does go pretty much over the top with any subject. And the anxiety is something I've been encountering for, since those early days, really. My little boy suffered a very severe allergic reaction to a slice of cake in a restaurant while we were on holiday. The cake contained walnuts. I'm terrified I will lose him. We are living with a ticking time bomb. And that was from the files of the Anaphylaxis Campaign back to 1994. I thought I'd talk just a little bit, although this is very much a food conference, about the patient's lifeline, as I've called it there. Because, avoidance is the main cornerstone of strategy for managing severe allergy, but there is you can get yourself out of trouble if you carry an adrenaline injector. And it was back in the 80s that that the EpiPen was developed based on the combo pen for chemical warfare antidote. So back in the 80s, this was soon turned into something that would carry adrenaline and which people could carry around with them, or epinephrine as it's known elsewhere in the world. And those are the main timelines there. Since about 1996, the EpiPen has been very widely prescribed in the UK. Some would say overprescribed. And then we had the Anapen, and now at the moment we have one called a new injector called Jext, which is just coming onto the market at the moment. So, as I say, although this is a food conference, I thought it's worth mentioning some of the timeline with regards to adrenaline. This was where the anaphylaxis campaign got involved. We early on met the guy in the picture there, Nicholas Soames, who was what was loosely termed the food minister at that time. And the newly formed anaphylaxis campaign met Nicholas Soames, and he was very instrumental in ensuring that there was a very robust message put throughout the UK food industry. And everyone began to take notice. Retailers and manufacturers began to develop policies. Industry organisations such as the BRC, FDF, developed codes of practice. And the EC at that time was discussing mandatory allergen labelling. And a lot of this was to do with the push that Nicholas Soames gave this whole subject. And just a few bullet points there on what MAF, the old MAF, and the FSA were doing. Allergy aware packs aimed at caterers, web guidance for industry and consumers, consumer attitude surveys may contain guidance published. I mean, all of those, many of those you may already know about. Some very, very strong work undertaken by MAF and the FSA. And I think it's true to say that without the work of the FSA in this country, I think food allergy wouldn't have gained the profile that it has gained today. And indeed, perhaps we wouldn't be having such a sensible conversation about it. In 1998, the government's Committee on Toxicity issued guidance for families on the introduction of peanuts into the diet, another milestone during the story of food allergy. This guidance stated that mothers in atopic families may wish to avoid peanuts while pregnant and breastfeeding. And unfortunately, this was mistranslated by many of the newspapers, as mothers-to-be generally are told to avoid peanuts, and this was a very wrong message. It was a specific message aimed at atopic families, but it became much more of a scare story out there. Indeed, the advice was rescinded in 2009. That's really a good example about how the media can tend to kind of distort something. During that period, I was aware of further UK deaths. Lucy Crawford, she had a Chinese takeaway, and that Chinese takeaway included a curry sauce, and she dipped one chip into the curry sauce, realised suddenly that it was made with peanut butter, and died very quickly. Louise Westlake had a company's Christmas dinner at the Manchester Hilton, and she ate a bread roll, which she thought was an ordinary bread roll. She knew she was nut allergic, and unfortunately, the bread roll contained walnuts. It was meant to contain walnuts, but there was a communication breakdown, and she died. And Laura Thrasher, you can imagine this, first night at Cambridge, you know, a great occasion. She just got into Cambridge, but she was very shy and plainly quite overwhelmed being at Cambridge on her first night. The dinner that she ate had a dessert with nuts in it. She didn't like to make a fuss, didn't like to ask all the relevant questions about whether there were nuts in the dessert, and she died. And this was Ross Bailey in 1999. Ross ate a coronation chicken sandwich not knowing it contained nuts. Now, most of us in this room probably know that coronation chicken has its recipe is a nut recipe. In other words, it's got not just chicken. It's not just a chicken sandwich. It has, I think it has mayonnaise in it, one or two other things, but it has almonds in it. But Ross thought he was eating a plain chicken sandwich. There were nuts in it, and he died. And this, in the House of Commons, this engendered a debate in which Edward Davy MP said, when a fit, gifted young athlete dies because of a few bites of a chicken sandwich, it is surely our duty to ask whether his death and others could have been avoided. So again, in another milestone in public awareness, I have kind of stressed some of the very bad side of allergy, the extreme side of allergy, the deaths. We all know that food allergy can be managed, but I make no apology for mentioning all of these rather extreme occurrences, because these are events that certainly raise the profile of food allergy, certainly in this country. And it was because of all of that awareness that was being raised really since the 1980s that new legislation finally came in on the labelling of allergens. And we all know about this. This was, first of all, it was 11 allergens plus sulfites in pre-packed food, subject to mandatory labelling. This effectively abolished the 25% rule, and then mollusks and lupin were added in 2006. So at the moment we have 13 food allergens plus sulfites, which are subject to mandatory labelling. Why lupin? Well, it's not a common problem in this country, although it could become one. Sweet lupin is grown for its edible seeds. It's related to the lupin flower. These seeds can be eaten raw or used to make flour, and we do hear of reactions occurring occasionally on the continent and indeed in the UK. So a genuine allergen, one that has caused serious problems in certain parts of Europe. And in the UK, this man, who I knew quite well at the time, he reacted to a meat pie which he'd eaten in his office canteen. And the pastry contained lupin flour imported from France. He knew he was allergic to peanuts and thought it must have been a peanut reaction. And when all the investigation was complete, it transpired that the pastry imported from France contained lupin flour, and that was the problem allergen for him. And a woman reacted to an Asda apple flan and an onion ring on separate occasions, both contained lupin flour. Somebody else reacted to a bread bought in an in-store bakery. The bread contained lupin flour. So from time to time, we are hearing of these reactions to lupin. So it's not just one that's a problem for France or Holland. It can happen here. Question mark there. Could this be the next one on the list? I don't know. I do know that kiwi allergy is becoming fairly common and quite a problem amongst some children. It was introduced in the late 1960s. Emerging cases were seen first of all in adults. And in the 1990s, severe cases were starting to be seen, starting to become fairly common. And these were happening more commonly in children. And there was some pretty good research down in Southampton that drew a picture of this, showing that you know, that it was certainly an allergen that was worth taking note of. But, of course, other food triggers. We can't just focus only on those 13 plus sulfites. Any food that contains protein can be an allergen for someone somewhere. And during my time with the anaphylaxis campaign, all of these foods here were flagged up from time to time as causing problems. Banana, green peas, pumpkin seeds, apples, avocado, chickpeas, not just Tesco chickpeas. Apologies to Tesco if you're here. And carrots. So there we are. There's many more in addition to that small number there. buckwheat, ? Is it one to watch? Well, I'm hearing some reports over here of reactions to buckwheat. More commonly, you hear of reactions in elsewhere in the world, such as Japan, but yes, I'm hearing them here. It's a major allergen in Japan where labeling is mandatory. It's actually not a true cereal. It's related to rhubarb. So people with wheat allergy can usually eat it. Used in savory pancakes, Japanese noodles, Russian blinis. And here's one UK case that I was involved in. A young woman suffered anaphylaxis after eating canapes. It started off as a real mystery, but fortunately she had a very good allergist who was aware of buckwheat allergy and who knew what to look for. So studying the ingredient list, he found pretty quickly that he should be testing this woman for buckwheat, and indeed the testing was positive. Of course, I have to talk about may contain. It's the one of the allergy-related subjects that is causing most frustration amongst consumers for obvious reasons. I'd always thought food labelling was there to help and protect the consumer, but now I wonder if it really exists to protect the food industry. Food companies put nut warnings on everything to cover themselves. I just can't believe the risk is real. I'll eat anything with a warning on it. And I've heard that comment from teenagers many, many times. And I think it's very, very risky behavior because 19 times out of 20, there may be no cross-contamination. And on that 20th time, who knows, there could be a real problem. So as the anaphylaxis campaign, when I was working with the anaphylaxis campaign and with the work I do for them now, we always say heed the warning label every time. We ignore all may contain warnings since we found one on a cabbage. Perhaps that's a genuine reason. I've no idea, but the real point, I suspect not, but the real point I'm making here is that if you're allergic to nuts and you see a may contain nuts warning on a cabbage, you will then start to doubt it. You will become very, very cynical about it and think, well, it's just the industry, food companies covering themselves. So you stop believing it. The whole thing becomes devalued. Is this a little extreme? Can you see that all right? It's got the set there, almost got the set. It's a sachet of tomato sauce. Nuts may contain nuts, peanuts, sesame, mustard, celery, fish, eggs, milk, soybeans, sulfites, and cereals containing gluten. Very popular, I'm told, amongst people allergic to lupin because it seems to be okay if you're allergic to that. But again, is that there for a real reason, a good reason? Probably not. Almost certainly not. Now, here's another one. Here's a can of milk with a nut statement. Recipe, no nuts. Ingredients, cannot guarantee nut-free. Well, a can of milk. Again, I've no idea at the real risk level involved here, but you can imagine that people seeing that would no longer trust the whole idea of may contain. A packet of chewing gum. Ingredients, cannot guarantee nut-free. Does anyone hear from that particular company? You know who you are. Okay, so that's a little bit of a snapshot of the very real issue of may contain. How am I doing for time? Good. Food allergy alerts. This, probably the late 90s, early 2000s, the anaphylaxis campaign has been sending out allergy alerts to its allergic members whenever something goes wrong, like something is wrong, a food product wrongly labeled. And the Food Standards Agency also has this very good system. I focused on the anaphylaxis campaign figures here because those are the ones I was involved in. 36 alerts sent out in 2006, it peaked at 65 in 2008 and then dropped slightly, but still considerable number of food allergy alerts. These are now delivered by text message, which is great because If you do carry a mobile phone, it means you get the message pretty much straight away. Examples? Well, there were many examples, as the figures show, but here's just a few of those. Undeclared egg in spaghetti bolognese. The packaging had been printed using old artwork file. A packaging error involving pumpkin and red pepper soup. Some product contained mushroom and celeriac soup. Ghee in a biryani, not identified as coming from milk. Ghee is a kind of, not sure what it is, but it's clarified butter. Thank you. But it's certainly got milk in it. Whether there's a lot of milk protein, I'm not sure, but it should be flagged up. And a chocolate-covered peanut found in a pack of chocolate-covered raisins. Extremely serious. And in fact, one young boy, not through that case, but one young boy did die through such a mistake. I do need to talk about free from. It's in a way quite a controversial subject, but the whole idea of free from food grew up because organizations like the Anaphylaxis Campaign and others were saying, this is what you mustn't eat, don't eat this, don't eat that. And people were saying, well, we're fed up with you telling us what we can't eat. Will somebody please tell us what we can eat? And so food companies began to introduce free-from ranges. For example, Sainsbury's have an aisle of free-from foods, mainly geared towards people who have problems with gluten or milk. The public likes it, but I think there's a downside to this. Shoppers do tend to take shortcuts and ignore the ingredient list, and we do tell people time and time again that's where you must look to get the crucial information. And people want shortcuts, and they take shortcuts. More than that, the phrase free from is a problem in itself, I think. It suggests to people, to the average person, an absolute value. Consumers expect it to mean total absence. And there have been occasions, certainly in this country, where free-from products have been tested to reveal traces of the allergen that wasn't supposed to have. And in fact, there was a case last week of a retailer having to recall a particular product marketed as free-from milk because something had gone wrong and there were traces detected. People have reacted, as I've said there. Here's a mistake with free-from. I usually set a test here, if anyone can spot that one. Agonizing, isn't it, when you put on the spot like this? But the clue really is the bit near the bottom, free from gluten. So it makes a free from gluten statement, but as you can see, it contains 13% couscous. So I think that was a withdrawal, but it was certainly alert I was involved in. I'm pretty sure it was withdrawn. Packs of carabices were labelled 100% dairy-free. You can't get freer than that. But a toddler reacted. And when testing was done, it was very positive for milk. One carob sample contained 1.6% casein, the other 2.7%. And there was a recall. So my message here, really, and I don't know if others agree or not, but the message, I think, should be food companies wishing to label products free from X, Y, or Z must be confident there's virtually no chance of cross-contact. And we all know that there's no such thing as 100% freedom from risk in any area of life. But I think many, many extra steps do need to be taken with products marketed as free from. A little bit about this. I won't dwell too long on it, but there are new rules on gluten labelling so that whereas threshold limits for most of the allergens have not yet been ascertained. Nevertheless, with gluten, we do now have that 20 ppm figure, and I probably don't have to say too much about that. And I'm not going to say too much about this because we have a very good speaker coming up fairly soon who I'm sure will be talking about thresholds, but this is a question that has been troubling the industry for some time. Is there a dose beneath which people are unlikely to react? Can safe levels be reached, be set that industry could work to? And there has been much progress on this, and you will be hearing more about this, but not from me, because I'm less qualified than some of the other speakers here. But I will talk about some of the research projects which I think do offer a lot of hope for the future. For example, these two here. Can we stop children becoming allergic to food in the first place? Now, the received wisdom has always been that introducing the foods early on has been somewhere at the root of the problem, and somehow the immune system has reacted strongly against being introduced to a food early on. But the EAT and LEAP studies, both based in London, both of these studies want to show that actual introduction of allergenic foods at an early stage during a particular window of opportunity may actually prevent allergy from developing. And this does challenge established thinking. And I think I'm very optimistic that these two studies, which have some very good people behind them, I really feel are onto something. LEAP is working with peanut. It's actually giving small amounts of peanut to high-risk children, in other words, atopic children who have a history of egg allergy and or eczema, at high risk for peanut allergy. So can we stop those children developing peanut allergy? Well, that's what LEAP is working with. EAT is working with an entire population, not just the atopic population, with a larger number of foods. Again, introducing these foods during a particular window early on, trying to demonstrate that introduction will tolerize these children and therefore solving the problem. We won't have the answers yet for a few years. I forget the exact timelines, but it's a few years yet for both of them. And indeed, can allergy be cured? I put that in quotes because I know that medics don't necessarily like the word cured in this context. But oral and sublingual immunotherapy are both being tried. Oral immunotherapy works by introducing small amounts of peanut into the diet of children and gradually building up to larger amounts. And researchers at Adam Brooks in Cambridge, and indeed Wesley Burks' team over in the US and others around the world, are working to show that where you have children already allergic to certain foods, such as peanut, that with a very careful regime of introduction, very closely watched and closely monitored, you can reduce reduce the symptoms that the child will have during an inadvertent exposure. So some success so far, both at Adam Brooks and in the US, with oral immunotherapy, and also in the USA with sublingual, where the allergen is put under the tongue, in fact, and that hopefully will have a similar effect. Well, that's me done. As I mentioned earlier, I was my history really has been with the anaphylaxis campaign. And we've got the chairman of the anaphylaxis campaign talking later today. But my own work at the moment has now moved into my own company called Food Allergy Support. So I would strongly recommend you, and I would, wouldn't I, I suppose. But I would strongly recommend you, first of all, to get in touch with the anaphylaxis campaign, because they have a corporate membership scheme which seeks to give ongoing help to the food industry, and indeed looks for support from the industry. And with my own work, I do training for industry on the particular subject of food allergens. And I work with a company called Food Integrity Consulting, who have a long history of working with allergens, in starting off in retail, and they now run their own company. So together we run training courses and awareness sessions. So if you do need help, do get in touch. Well, that's the self-promotion done. And I'm sure you'll have a very good conference. Thank you.